This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Now that the iPad is on the shelves, tech chatter has moved on to the next generation iPhone. Last week, a blog called Gizmodo published pictures and descriptions of an unreleased version of the iPhone. As NPR's Laura Seidel reports, the blog and the man who gave them the iPhone may have committed a crime.
According to Gizmodo, here's what happened. A guy was in a bar, and he happened to stumble upon something shiny, the new, not yet released iPhone. The guy claims he called Apple, but no one called him back. So Gizmodo pays this guy $5,000 for the phone. Then the blog publishes pictures and a description, and rabid Apple fans race to the site. Gizmodo gets a call from Apple. The company wants its phone back. Yesterday, Gizmodo revealed that police are involved. They raided the home of their editor, Jason Chen, and confiscated his computers as part of an investigation into whether the iPhone was stolen. The guy who found the phone and Gizmodo could be guilty of theft under California law, says attorney Sam Byard of the Citizen Media Law Project.
California law imposes a duty on him if he doesn't know who the owner is to turn it over to the police. And I think there's a serious question about whether he violated the law by selling it to them and whether they violated the law by receiving it or buying it.
That may be true, but the police investigation is also bumping up against California's shield law for journalists. Although bloggers are still not considered journalists in all states, they are in California, says Jennifer Granick, an attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Police can't just take Editor Chen's computers.
California law says they can't get access to any notes or photographs or data of any kind that was prepared as part of news gathering.
The San Mateo police are backing down a bit. They say they are examining the shield law, and they haven't looked at what's on the computers yet. The shield law is meant to protect sources of important news stories who might not come forward if authorities force journalists to reveal their names. For example, says Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute, recent stories in the New York Times about CIA secret prisons probably relied on classified information from sources who could have been arrested if their names were revealed. But being the first kid on the block to get a new iPhone is hardly a matter of national security. McBride says even if Gizmodo is covered by the shield law, the fact that they paid for the iPhone raises some serious ethical questions for journalists.
People will distort information if they know that there's a significant amount of money available to them. People will steal information.
Unfortunately, McBride says we are likely to see more of this kind of behavior because of a growing number of media outlets that cater to people with very specific specialties, Apple products or celebrity gossip.
So they have a niche that expects them to pay for information, that expects them to get the text messages from the latest mistress of the famous golfer.
McBride says in an increasingly competitive media world, the pressure to do what it takes to get attention is going to grow. Gizmodo says that its page views went through the roof after they published the next generation iPhone pictures. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Women are always daughters. They may or may not become wives, professionals, or mothers, but they're always somebody's daughter, wondering what their mother might think of them. Patty Davis, who had a pretty famous mother and father in Ronald and Nancy Reagan, has written a book in which many women, including Anna Quindlen, Lily Tomlin, Whoopi Goldberg, and Anne Rice, try to tell the story of the relationship that shifts, twists, and changes with their mothers. The book is called The Lives Our Mothers Leave Us, and on this weekend before Mother's Day, we welcome Patty Davis, who's written 7 books, including her autobiography and a couple of novels. She's at member station KCRW in Santa Monica. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Near as I could figure, all of the daughters that talk about their mothers in your book seem to be a bit north of 40.
Yeah, that was deliberate.
Okay. What's the reason for that?
Well, if you're ever going to get the depth of your parental relationships, particularly your relationship with your mother, there's just something about that age. It's sort of, I've equated it to kind of to going to an art gallery and standing back from a painting so that you can see it better. You know, I think that is something with age and wisdom mm-hmm. that you come to, that you can't change your history. So you have two choices. You can either make the best of it and understand how you came to be the person who you are in all of the good ways, either because of your mother or despite what your mother did or however, you know. I mean, if I could choose one word to encapsulate this whole book, it would be acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
Every single woman, no matter what their story was with her mother, had come to a place of acceptance.
You take a bite of the apple of the Judy Garland story by talking, not to the obvious suspect, Liza Minnelli, but Lorna Luft. Being Judy Garland's daughter has to be tough under any circumstances.
Yeah.
We're talking about a woman who was a legend not only in show business, but obviously in the circles of spiraling downwards between mm-hmm. Drugs and drinking, meeting the wrong men, several suicide attempts, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
Lorna was, you're right, at one point she was kind of assigned to dole out her mother's pills.
Well, not only dole them out, empty out the capsules and fill them with sugar. And she was like 10, 11 years old. And Lorna was told that if her mother ever did overdose, she was not to call the paramedics, she was mm-hmm. not to call the police, she was to call the manager. And she was 17 when her mother died. And at the funeral, there were thousands of people standing around. Lorna found herself comforting other people. And I completely related to that because I found myself when my father died doing the same thing.
In our family, we used to have a picture up on the refrigerator of my wife when she was like a 5-year-old girl. And one of our daughters, then three, said, "Who's that?" And I said, "That's Mama," when she was just a couple years older than you. And her daughter said, "Where are you?"
Yeah.
Because as far as she's concerned, we've always been together just waiting for our daughters to come around. Do we need to remind ourselves, our parents, our mothers specifically, were fully formed people before we ever got here?
Yes, and I think that was, especially the deeper I got into the book, all of these women had... Every one of them had already investigated their mother's past, except Whoopi Goldberg, which...
She didn't know how old her mother is.
She doesn't know anything about her mother's past. And I said, I don't understand. Why? And she said, she just feels like it doesn't matter. What matters is, you know, her life with us and her as our mother, Whoopi and her brother,
mm-hmm.
and her own story doesn't matter. But it was very profound. Because I was late into the book by the time I interviewed Whoopi, and so I was very aware of how important it is to understand how your mother grew up and what mm-hmm. influenced her and what she brought to the task of mothering.
Let me ask you about Juliana Margulies, because she grew up with a mother who was, I think it's safe to say, just not into being mom.
Well, she... Her mother had her at a rather young age. She and her husband were really children of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to travel around and be hippies, and she had three girls and, you know, loved them, but she was always moving around. I mean, she'd take them to Germany. She'd take them here. She was always changing her mind. And then when Juliana was already a pretty successful actress and she was back home, staying at her mother's house while she was doing a play back east. And she lay down on the couch and she was taking a nap. And she woke up and she saw her mother standing at the ironing board singing. And she went, what are you doing? And her mother holds up this bottle of spray starch or whatever it was and said, "Have you tried this? It's fantastic." And Juliana said, "Who are you?" And she said, "I was so young when I had you girls, and I loved you, you know, desperately, but I really wasn't ready to be a mother. And I'm ready to be a mother now." And went back to her ironing and her singing.
Mm. May I ask, how's your mother doing?
She's doing well. You know, she's 88, and she's had some falls, but she's... She's well. I mean, she gets around.
And I make bold to ask this just because obviously you've written about it in the book. How are you and your mother doing?
We're doing well. You know, if you've had a challenging relationship with your mother, and certainly I have, I think then acceptance is really, really has to be a lifeline. And, you know, I was aware recently that I had kind of thought, well, you know, I've done so much work on this, on processing my history and my relationship with my mother, that she's really, you know, she's just stopped trying to push my buttons. But then I kind of backed up a little bit more and really looked at our exchanges, and I thought, no, she's actually trying really hard to push my buttons. It's just that my buttons are not that accessible anymore, you know? You know, my part of the equation has changed, right?
Well, maybe that's growing up.
It is growing up. Because the truth of the matter is, the older we get, we don't need to give our mothers that much power over us. We really can grow up.
Patty Davis, her new book, The Lives Our Mothers Leave Us. She joined us from KCRW in Santa Monica. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
A generation used to last 25 years or so. It was defined by shared experiences, including wars, presidents, the Depression, music, movies, various inventions. The generation of Woodstock, LSD, and the war in Vietnam was different from the generation of Elvis, big-finned automobiles, and the post-war baby boom. Larry Rosen, a professor of psychology at California State University, says that today, generations may change every few years because new technology creates substantially different experiences every few years. Professor Rosen has written a new book, Rewired, Understanding the I Generation and the Way We Learn. He joins us from the studios of NPR West. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
So how are, I don't know, today's 12-year-olds a whole generation different from 18-year-olds or 5-year-olds?
Well, one of the interesting things about the teenage generation, the I generation, they have learned technology basically from birth. They want to be able to text on mom or dad's phone as soon as they can grab the phone, whereas the generation just above them, their older brothers and sisters in the net generation, they certainly came to technology at some point, but not as young and not as overwhelmingly prevalent in their lives.
And what difference does this make, though? Or what differences does it make? Because you lay out quite a few.
Well, first of all, the little I in I generation stands for both things like the iPod or the iPhone or the Wii, but it also really stands for individualized. And this generation has gotten very used to having things their way. They want all their technology individualized, and they want it all available all the time.
I was fascinated by what you say in the book about their adroitness at multitasking.
This is a generation, and this is actually a fairly controversial topic right now. This is a generation that does lots of things at the same time. They always have their iPod earbuds in while they're doing their homework. They have the television on in the background. They are taking breaks and texting when somebody texts them. It appears like they're multitasking. I would prefer to look at it as they are very, very good task switchers. Mm-hmm. And they have learned very early when there is downtime or slack time in task A, like doing some homework or searching for something on the web. And then when they get a text, they can decide when to return that text when it doesn't get in the way of their learning. I see my students texting a lot, and I will often stop them and ask them, did you just understand what I just said? And they can repeat back verbatim what I said. So they're clearly paying attention.
There's so many technologies that enable youngsters nowadays to create their own content. But, you know, I guarantee you, no 13-year-old I've ever met can, at this point in their lives, write a book that's as good or as necessary or important for them to read as anything written by fill-in-the-blank, Judy Blume, J.D. Salinger. And those books are what take them into other skins and other experiences.
We lived in a generation, we grew up in a generation where books were critical. They were important. Turning the pages of a book was important. Reading a newspaper was important. I think that's fine and dandy, but these kids live in a different world. Mm-hmm. They actually read more than any generation. They just don't read necessarily the same amount of books. They write more than any generation. They don't write novels, but they could, mm-hmm. and they will. Parents need to recognize that their kids do need these experiences. They can't let them just sit in their rooms and be online all the time because they're quiet. They need mm-hmm. to engage them. They need to talk to them. And I think, sadly, in too many families from our research, we find that parents are very happy with that their kids are in their bedrooms quiet. Therefore, they can feel comfortable that their kids are safe, when in fact, their kids are really developing a mindset that their only thing in the world is technological and media-driven, where it shouldn't be. There has to be a balance.
Larry Rosen, professor of psychology at California State University and author of the new book, Rewired, Understanding the I Generation and the Way They Learn. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Last week, we reported on a backlash in college classrooms over the use of laptop computers. Our report included this scene from one classroom.
Don't bring laptops and work on them in class. I made my point clear?
That was Professor Kieran Mullen of the University of Oklahoma, and he told us, you neglected to mention that the incident was entirely staged. No unwilling student's laptop was harmed. Professor Mullen says that laptops in the classroom are part of what he called the evolution of electronic etiquette. He writes, 5 years ago, cell phones might commonly go off in class. Students who routinely multitask at home are learning what is acceptable behavior in the classroom. Society will sort this all out in time. Multitask while you listen to Weekend Edition from NPR News.